Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9-3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
The joy of winning is a very tough thing to explain to people. It's a very tough emotion to really kind of verbalize. But racing is such a fickle business. You know, all the cliches, you're only as good as your last race, whatever, whatever. The fear of failure, the fear of never winning again was almost more of a motivator than feeling the winning feeling, if that makes sense.
Motivated by that fear of never winning again, James Hinchcliffe took 6 wins and 18 podiums in IndyCar. But perhaps his biggest challenge was returning to the racetrack after a near fatal crash.
I woke up from the accident. You know, I couldn't even speak. I had to write it on pen and paper. My third question was, when can I get back in the car? You're so fearful of losing this thing you've worked so hard for. You've sacrificed so much for your entire life. And so you immediately are like, I can get back in a car, right? When can that happen?
It's 10 years since James's freak accident during practice for the 2015 Indy 500. Here on F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, he tells us how he miraculously survived that crash, why he lied to himself about what happened, and the emotions he felt when he took pole at the very same racetrack 1 year later. A huge fan of F1 from a young age and now offering his expert insight as a pundit on F1 TV, James also tells us why he didn't try to become an F1 driver himself and whether he thinks the United States needs an American on the grid. Hinch is very articulate and interesting, and his take on this year's world title fight between Oscar Piastri and Lando Norris is fascinating, as are his thoughts on the role that Max Verstappen will play in Red Bull's rebuild into world title contenders. I hope you enjoy it.
James, great to have you on the show. Thanks for your time. How are things?
Of course. Thanks so much for having me. Things are well. Things are well. We're here at a racetrack, so life's good.
Well, you haven't been to an F1 race track for a while. What do you most look forward to seeing when you come back to F1?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, it sounds corny. The people, you know, the people that I get to work with on the F1 TV side are a great group. And, you know, I started working with them back in 2022. And in all honesty, I came into this feeling like a little bit of an outsider, a little bit of imposter syndrome. I never raced an F1. I haven't even driven an F1 car. What business do I have, you know, talking about Formula One to anyone? But it quite quickly became something I really enjoyed doing because everybody, you know, welcomed me so much in the whole paddock, and it's been great getting to know some of these people. And I don't get to see them all year, so it's kind of nice every time I come back.
What about the cars, the machinery?
One of the things I'm very lucky to get to do in this job is I get to go stand trackside, right? You know, when you're walking in and out of the paddock, you don't see the cars. You can do weekends where if you're in the comms box, maybe instead of doing some of the remote stuff, you won't see a car in person. You know, you're watching it on TV, even though it's happening right beside you. So in this role, I get the opportunity to go stand trackside, you know, most practice sessions. And that is phenomenal. I mean, in Japan, at Suzuka, standing kind of in between turns 1 and 2, even as somebody that's done this my whole life, I mean, watching these things come through at pace in some of the quick corners is absolutely breathtaking. Mm.
And the development rate, I'm still astounded by. I mean, the last dry qualifying we had at Spa-Francorchamps was full dry qualifying, was in 2022. And Max Verstappen's pole time 3 years later in 2025 would have been 1 second slower than Lance Stroll, who was last this year.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
There's really no other form of motorsport that does it quite at that rate. And, you know, it's one of the fun things every weekend is you look through the F1 or the FIA bulletins on who's brought what upgrades. And it's amazing the pace at which these teams develop. We get to kind of see it all over again now in 2026, because the rate of development when a new regulation set comes in is just going to be, you know, even exponentially higher than kind of what we've seen the last year or two.
What about drivers? I know you've been full on, you know, at Indy for the last couple of months, but you've been keeping a really close eye. What has stood out for you about 2025? Who stood out?
Well, I mean, you know, this ebb and flow between Oscar and Lando is incredible, isn't it? I mean, it's the kind of championship battle. If you're going to have one team dominating, you at least want both drivers, you know, competitive enough to push each other and fight for wins. And we've been lucky enough to have that this year. So kind of seeing the ebb and flow, the change in momentum from one side of the garage to the other, trying to keep tabs on inter-team relations a little bit, and you know, how much are they starting to really understand that we're getting to crunch time in the championship? It's by no means a guarantee that they'll be in this position next year or potentially ever again. That's what's so crazy about Formula One. And so for both of these drivers, this could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As corny as that sounds, it's quite literally could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to fight for a driver's championship.
And what do you see as each of their strengths?
I think, you know, Oscar's mental consistency, his emotional consistency, I think is a massive strength. He's unflappable, right? He's almost, you know, Kimi Jr. in the Iceman moniker, right? I mean, you hear him on the radio, good, bad, or indifferent. He sort of lives right here. And I know that outside of the car, away from the track, I'm sure he has a full range of emotions, just like every other person does. But I think it's so important as an athlete to be able to kind of harness that, compartmentalize, and stay in that zone. What I love about Lando is he's learned what works for him, and people are different. Not everybody is set off by the same things. Not everybody is motivated by the same things. And learning what makes you tick and what makes you perform at your best, I think, is a very important thing for an athlete to be able to achieve. I think too often we look at some of the greats in any sport and think that, okay, we have to replicate that. How did they do it? How did they approach it? How did they execute it? To be a great at that level, you must do the same. I don't think that's necessarily true. In some ways, yes. Certainly maybe in some procedural stuff and specific stuff on the racetrack. But from a mental approach, everybody is different. And Lando has seemingly discovered that being this open, honest, publicly self-critical person actually helps him get the best out of himself. And so for the people that think it's not the right approach or it shows weakness, I actually disagree. I think it shows quite a bit of strength, because it's not easy to stand up in front of a global audience like Formula One and say, yeah, that's on me.
Put your helmet on. Imagine you are one of those drivers. As we get to crunch time, the business end of the season, is part of your remit to work on the weakness of your rival? Do you think they each know what the weakness is? And just even when they're in a debrief, might they just be sort of prodding on the shoulder a bit?
I would be very surprised if that isn't the way it goes, if it hasn't started already. For me, I always think back to 2016, the relationship, the friendship that Lewis and Nico had at one point in their life, and how in the heat of a championship battle, all bets were off, you know, no more Mr. Nice Guy. And it was even these small little things they could do to each other to try to get that, you know, that mental advantage, that psychological advantage. I can't help but think that that is going to come into play again at some point, if it hasn't already.
And as the senior guy, Lando, seventh year in Formula One, do you think he's feeling more pressure?
I think both drivers are acutely aware of just how rare this opportunity is. Yes, it took Lando 7 years to be in a position where he was in a car that could do what it's doing now. It's only taken Oscar a few, but both realize, I think, that this is potentially a fleeting opportunity. And so I don't think there's more pressure on one than the other. I think they're both very aware of how important these next few months are.
Hinch, it's so interesting to get your perspective, because in a way, yours is unique. Okay, you've been there and done it in IndyCar. You've won 6 races. You've won in Atlantic. You've won in Indy Lights. And you've spent a lot of time since you retired from IndyCar observing all sorts of championships around the world. When you look at the winners, the serial winners, the Verstappens, the Hamiltons, even the Scott Dixons, right, in IndyCar, what do they all have that the others don't?
I mean, I don't think it's any one thing, certainly. I think right off the bat, what you have to say is they've got a tremendous support system, right? I mean, no driver does this on their own. The teams play such a huge part in this. And when you look at a lot of those periods of dominance, it's rare that you have the situation that we have now where kind of both drivers on the team or multiple drivers on a team in, say, an IndyCar sense are performing at that level. Any sort of team dominance is usually accompanied by one driver really standing out within that team. But when you look at some of those names, the number one thing I honestly think is work ethic. You hear stories, you watch documentaries, you know, you read books about great athletes, pick your sport, football, basketball, baseball, golf, tennis, whatever. There is always this unrelenting work ethic behind the greats. You know, if you've watched the Michael Jordan documentary and you see how obsessed he is with winning, how obsessed he is with his craft. And Verstappen's the perfect example of that, right? I mean, this guy lives and breathes motorsports to a degree that I don't think anyone else on the grid does. And you're talking about 20 of the most competitive and successful drivers in the world. I do think it takes an obsession to really reach those levels.
And what causes the obsession? Is it a fear of failure?
I think that's different for every driver. That's what it was for me.
Fear of failure for you?
It was a fear of losing. The joy of winning is a very tough thing to explain to people. It's a very tough emotion to really kind of verbalize. But racing is such a fickle business. You know, all the cliches, you're only as good as your last race, whatever, whatever. The fear of failure, the fear of never winning again was almost more of a motivator than feeling the winning feeling, if that makes sense.
This makes me think of Scottie Scheffler, the golfer. Just before the British Open, he came out with, you know, he said it's not a fulfilling life. You know, we're talking about the world's number one golfer, not a fulfilling life. And he finds himself asking, what's the point? And if that is his attitude, you talk about work ethic. I'm sure he's out on the driving range before anyone else, right? But if you're asking yourself, what's the point? That must be hard to find the motivation.
Absolutely. Which almost makes it even more impressive you know, because you think, again, to stick on the golf reference, Tiger Woods had that unrelenting work ethic, but he loved it. You could tell. I mean, he did it up until the point his body failed him and then kept going for a few more years. What Scheffler's doing is very, very unique in sport. The way he's sort of viewing his success is very unique. But I think there's a lot of truth in it for a lot of other people. I think there's a lot of people that if you really strip them down and ask them that question, that have been massively successful in whatever it is, sport, business, you know, whatever your vocation, I think a lot of people will tell you that it's lonely at the top and it's not everything they thought it would be.
Let's extrapolate this further then and talk about talent. What is your take on talent? Do you think, for example, that Max Verstappen's factory settings when he was born were just more in line with what you need to be a brilliant racing driver than 99.9% of other people? Or do you think it was nurture and the fact that Jos Verstappen put him on a go-kart at the age of 4 and just worked and worked and worked at it?
I think in that sort of case, it's probably a combination of both, right? I think Max is obviously born with a certain amount of the required, you know, physical acumen that someone needs. I make the joke all the time that racing drivers are kind of wired differently, right? We lack the self-preservation gene that most people have. And Max obviously has to have that. Any racing driver has to have that to strap yourself into one of these things and go risk your life every weekend. But then, no, I think Jos played a huge part in it. But Max's natural disposition had to be willing to accept that kind of coaching, right? That kind of approach could crush somebody, especially at a young age, especially a young kid. And it didn't crush Max. It created Max. And I think he had to have been born a certain way, wired a certain way to be able to kind of receive that type of coaching. So it's a very unique scenario, which is why you have this very unique driver that is, I mean, I think if you polled the grid and said, hey, other than yourself, who's the best driver on the grid? I think 19 people would say Max.
While we're on Max, just what are your thoughts on him staying at Red Bull for 26?
It makes sense. 26 is a risk anywhere you go. And so at least staying at Red Bull, he knows his surroundings very well. He's got a lot of faith and a lot of trust in the people that he works with. I think it's worth kind of getting through 26, assessing where things are, and then going from there.
Can I put this to you? Red Bull is a team in transition now, right? They've just had a change of management at the top. They've had a whole bunch of really talented people leave. They've got powertrains coming on in 26. Christian Horner said a few races back, if we're better than Mercedes, it's going to be embarrassing for them. So it feels like a team that is going to take a step back in 26 while it rebuilds. Max is a born winner, a once in a generational talent, but a born winner who might, do you think, get frustrated in that environment? Do you actually think Max is the right driver for Red Bull in 26, or should he actually be in a Mercedes winning races and leaving Red Bull to rebuild?
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, if I'm Red Bull, I want somebody that is as motivated as Max is to win, helping push that team forward. You know, if you are a team that's kind of rebuilding structurally and, you know, you're entering this kind of new world, you know, doing the power unit side of things as well, Max's feedback is obviously very good. He knows how to develop a car. He knows how to get the most out of a car. If I'm a team manager, if I'm an engineer, that's the driver that I want. One that knows exactly what he needs in a race car. You know that every time he drives it, he is getting every possible hundredth and thousandth out of it in any scenario. And whose hatred of losing is, again, maybe more powerful than his joy of winning. Because I think that just motivates the whole group.
But does that hatred of losing put too much pressure on a team that is rebuilding? Like, I'm thinking of sort of Senna at McLaren in 93, that kind of thing.
I think it depends how it manifests in Max and how he displays that to the team. And, you know, look, he's obviously matured a lot as a Formula One driver. He got into the sport very young. He was a kid. Now he's, you know, four-time champion. He's a new father. He's all these things. He's grown and matured in a lot of ways. I think the important thing is how you display that frustration and how you actually kind of turn that into something positive rather than just focusing on the negatives.
This episode is sponsored by Caldera Lab, my go-to brand for high-performance skincare designed specifically for men that's simple, effective, and backed by science. Because let's face it, most skincare products out there aren't made for men. And if they are, they're either packed with questionable ingredients or don't deliver the results they promise. But Caldera Lab is different. Studies show that 100% of men who use their products said their skin looked smoother and healthier, with over 93% reporting their skin had a more youthful appearance. That's because each product is carefully formulated through a combination of advanced science and high-quality non-toxic ingredients to support your skin health. The result? A simple, effective routine that actually works. And here's my cheat sheet if you're wondering where to get started. First up is The Good, their award-winning serum packed with antioxidants, which is your go-to if you're looking for smoothness and hydration. For reducing puffiness and dark circles, the Eye Serum is going to be your best friend. But look out for the base layer. This is the one I love and I use it every day. It's a moisturizer that gives a smooth, matte finish, zero shine, just healthy-looking skin in an instant. It's like magic and my favourite part of their recommended routine, which you can find online. Whether you're starting fresh or upgrading your routine, Caldera Lab makes skincare simple and effective. Don't settle for drugstore junk or steal your partner's products. Elevate your routine with skincare made for you. Head to calderalab.com/grid and use grid at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Hinch, we talked a lot about other drivers. Can we talk about you and your single-seater career now? Those six IndyCar wins, what was it, 18 podiums, the pole at Indy. How do you look back on that decade or a bit more in IndyCar?
Very fondly, you know. IndyCar was always my dream, and I grew up a kid in Toronto. The IndyCar race was kind of in our backyard starting the year I was born, so I've been to basically every version of that race and fell in love with motorsports, chasing Mario Andretti, you know, around the paddock for an autograph and Emerson Fittipaldi and things like that. And I mean, look, anybody that's in this sport at any level knows how difficult it is to, you know, to be a professional, to be a paid racing driver at any level of the sport is so difficult. To have managed to achieve the goal I set out, which was to be an IndyCar driver, to do it for, you know, a little over a decade, you can't be upset about that. Yes, you can lament races that you lost. You can look back at decisions that you made, career moves that maybe if you could do over, you'd have done differently. But what's the point? You know, the past is the past. You can't change it. I prefer to just kind of look back and think about how lucky I was to have got to do it.
Was F1 ever on your radar?
In all honesty, not really. Again, I grew up with this IndyCar influence, even though my dad was from England. So he was a big F1 fan. And we grew up, I mean, I watched every Grand Prix. You know, Sunday mornings was F1, Sunday afternoons was IndyCar. And that's just how, you know, my dad and I did our weekends. But I think the proximity I had to IndyCar made it just more appealing to me. My one sort of opportunity to come over to Europe and maybe try this side of things was after my season in Formula BMW. I performed well. BMW offered me a ride in the British Championship, which was kind of the benchmark for that series at the time. And this is where Hülkenberg came through and Rosberg came through and Vettel came through, all sort of the same era. And it was kind of a decision, you know, my family and I had to make was it worth dropping out of school, moving to Europe and kind of chasing this dream? And we decided at the time that it wasn't. You know, at the Formula BMW level, you're still very, very far away from making a living in motorsports. And education was very important to my parents. They didn't want me to drop out of school yet. And that was kind of, it wasn't even really an argument. I got the logic. And so I didn't really fight them on it.
Do you regret that now?
No, not at all. Because one of the things, as my career progressed and, you know, got to IndyCar and had some success, I would look at contemporaries who had gone the other way. And breaking into Formula One was always very challenging. You know, it still is. It will always be, as it should be. As a North American, I think it's additionally tough. I think not coming over to Europe, really from the karting age, or certainly the first level of junior formula cars at 14, 15, 16, makes it another step more difficult. And I would look at guys that I raced against that were incredibly talented that never got that opportunity, or even guys that did. And this is the part where it gets a little bit difficult, and I might cop a bit of hate for this, but I looked at drivers that got to Formula One, and you know, pre-cost cap era, the disparity between the haves and the have-nots was massive. The good cars and the bad cars were seconds apart, not tenths apart. And I would watch drivers have entire careers not even having a sniff of a top five. Actually zero chance to win any race all year long. And as a driver, I couldn't find the motivation in that. I get that it's you hope you do well enough that you get picked up by one of the teams that can fight for wins and championships. But to spend 8 years driving around, waking up every Sunday, thinking that like 12th is a good day, I don't think I could have done that. That's not what motivated me as a driver.
So what is your take on the likes of Checo Perez, who moved from Mexico to Germany at the age of 15? He had no plan B.
I remember he was sleeping on the couch of my friend in Oxford when we were doing A1GP together. Like I knew Checo, he was the reserve driver for A1T Mexico. No, but I have nothing but admiration for those kids and those families. You know, you hear a lot of the Australian, New Zealanders, you know, coming over from Europe and doing the same thing. They've got to give up everything, move over and commit. And I give them nothing but credit. And we love talking about the success stories. We very rarely focus on how many drivers did the same thing and they're, you know, back in New Zealand selling Holdens. You know, it's a cruel sport. It's an unfair sport. Timing is so much of it. And so for me, when I was coming up, when the era that I was growing up, the timing just didn't make sense for me to try to make a path towards F1.
Your most successful seasons in IndyCar were with Andretti. What did you have around you then that allowed you to get that success that you didn't have at other times?
I think, again, this is a bit of a cliche line, but I've said it for a very long time. Racing is not about cars or tires or engines. Racing is about people. And if you get the right group of people together in this sport, you can achieve some incredible things together. You don't always need the biggest budget. You don't always need the, you know, the fanciest factory or whatever. It really is about the people. And, you know, my time with Andretti, we had just an incredible group, engineers, mechanics, my teammates. It was a really fun time. And the results came, I think, as a result of this group of people just really being on the same wavelength.
How much of a setback was the crash at Indianapolis? In fact, can you take us through what happened during practice for Indy in 2015?
Yeah, so post-qualifying practice day at Indy, normal day at the Speedway. And during a run following Montoya, had a mechanical failure in the middle of one of the turns, launched the car into the wall, about 220 miles an hour. And that's a bad day on a good day. But in a really freak set of circumstances, a piece of the suspension actually pierced the tub and went straight through me and essentially shish kebabbed me inside the race car. I'd been impaled, and in that process, it hit my femoral artery in my left leg, and when the car came to a stop, I was essentially bleeding to death in the race car. I would not be here today without the work of the men and women of the safety team who got me out of the car, started to attempt to stop the bleeding. I was bleeding quite a bit. Got me to hospital. Obviously, everything worked out fine. But yeah, it took me out for the rest of the season as I was recovering.
Were you immediately aware of the severity of your injuries?
Mercifully, I was so concussed in the accident, I have no recollection of that. You know, I was driving. Everything was fine. As far as my memory goes, I blinked and I wake up on a table staring up at bright lights in a collar strapped to a board, tube down my throat. A lot of concerned people looking down. And no, even then, I mean, at that point, I realized something's gone wrong here. But it took a few days for me to understand how complicated the injury was and the severity of it, and you know, ultimately what the rehab time was going to be.
Hinch, you're a bright guy. How did you justify? How did you square away in your mind the risks of racing on ovals
before or after?
Okay,
or both?
Give us both. Yeah.
Well, before, it's simple. You know, I think any driver acknowledges racing's inherently dangerous. And when you're presented with an opportunity, you find ways to justify it. I think it's as simple as that.
How do you justify it? It'll never happen to me because I'm really good?
No, I think it was more, the sport's much safer than it was. You know, I'm not racing on ovals in the 70s with, you know, aluminum fuel cells sitting in the side pods. I'm not racing in an era where the driver's feet are in front of the front axle. And so I think you justify it by saying the safety's come so far, it's unlikely to happen to anyone. You don't even make it personal. It's, oh, that's not going to happen. And I was very ignorant, you know, when I got to IndyCar. By that point, you're racing on ovals. You've done Indy Lights. You've kind of learned to appreciate them for what they are. And they are amazing when you do learn to appreciate them. And I think I very ignorantly thought that I was racing in an era where we had passed the point of losing drivers. And then my rookie year, we lost Dan Weldon. And that was a bit of a wake-up call. But when you are young and you are naive and you're hungry for success, you justify in your head by thinking it's probably not going to happen. What are the chances lightning strikes twice, you know?
Am I right in thinking that Greg Moore was an inspiration for you as well?
He was, very much so.
Who, tragically, we lost on an oval as well.
Mm-hmm. And when I was young, Greg died in 99, and he was my hero. He was my guy. That day, I was, I think, 12 years old, maybe, racing go-karts. And that was the day I started hating oval racing. And I hated oval racing up until the day I was forced to do it if I was going to continue a career in IndyCar. You know, for a time there during the split in American Open Wheel, you had the Champ Car side, which really didn't run on ovals, and then the IRL, the Indy Racing League, which was, in its inception, exclusively ovals. Well, I don't like that series. I was on this side of the war. For a long time, I didn't really think it was something I was going to have to face. 08 happens, the merge happens, and it becomes a much more kind of balanced schedule. And the reality is, yeah, you're going to have to start doing this. And you had to face it.
Our next sponsor is Shopify. You need to wear a lot of different hats when you start your own business. You'll often find yourself switching roles from one hour to the next, from designer to marketer, customer service rep to accountant, and so much more. And that's why finding the right tool that not only helps you out, but simplifies everything is so important. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand's style. It's packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. And world-class expertise for everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. Plus, you can spread the word about your brand with built-in marketing and email tools to help you find and keep new customers. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Turn your big business idea into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Go to shopify.com/beyondthegrid. shopify.com/beyondthegrid. This episode is sponsored by Babbel. Learning a new language isn't just about ordering coffee or asking for directions. It opens doors to new experiences, new cultures, and even new friendships. So why not start the journey today? Babbel's conversation-based method teaches you phrases and words you'll actually use day to day. And its excellent speech recognition tool is on hand to make sure you're getting the pronunciation just right. And what I really like is how Babbel keeps you motivated, because that can be a real sticking point for all of us. But with progress trackers and real-time feedback to keep you accountable, it's like having your very own language coach in your pocket. There are over a dozen languages to choose from, including French, German, Spanish, and Portuguese. And some of the languages actually overlap with the races on the F1 calendar. So if you're already planning to join us in 2026, why not start making moves now? With Babbel, you'll be speaking confidently in another language in no time. In fact, studies have shown that just 15 hours on Babbel is equivalent to a full semester at college. I want you to learn another language, so I'm teaming up with Babbel to gift you 55% off subscriptions, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/grid. Get up to 55% off at babbel.com/grid, spelled babbel.com/grid. babbel.com/grid.
Back to the crash. You're out for the rest of 2015. Did you consider not racing again?
No.
Did you consider only doing road courses and street tracks?
No.
Because it is extraordinary that the very next year you go and put the car on pole for the Indianapolis 500. Phenomenal. How difficult was that?
It was difficult in the sense that qualifying pole at Indy is always difficult because you've got 32 other teams and drivers trying to beat you.
But Hinch, you must have had so much going on in your head just getting into the car.
No, you're giving me too much credit. Yeah,
you take the chip out.
A little bit. You know, I woke up from the accident, understood, you know, what had happened. I was out for the year. Fine. My third question when I woke up, you know, I couldn't even speak. I had to write on pen and paper because I had a tube down my throat. My third question was, when can I get back in the car? And that's not an inspirational story. That's not an uncommon story. I think most drivers, when they are faced with an injury, you're so fearful of losing this thing you've worked so hard for. You've sacrificed so much for your entire life. And so you immediately are like, I can get back in a car, right? When can that happen? How I sort of reconciled the whole situation, there was two elements, I think, that really helped make getting back in the car not an issue for me at all. The first was I had no memory of the impact, of the extraction, of the pain that I would have been feeling on the day. I think that's important. I don't have flashbacks of a crash. And then the other thing was, I made a very conscious effort very early in my recovery to not associate anything that I was going through with the race car. I told myself I had a car accident because in my head, I didn't know any different. I had no memory of it. So I told myself it was a car accident. I watched the video. Like, I knew it wasn't a car accident, but I managed to just push it out of my head that the race car had done this to me. It was something unrelated. And it was never a question about getting back in the car.
Did it help that it was a mechanical and that it wasn't a driver error?
I have thought about that as well. And I do think that's an element of it, because it's not like you think, hey, in that same scenario, would I make the same decision that led to this outcome? Or will I not take that same risk because I'm afraid of what could happen? It was dumb luck. You know, it was bad luck. And so I do think that makes it easier too.
Right. So you put it on the pole. Can you remember now, 10 years on almost, the emotions?
Yes, I can. And it's funny, man. I think back about that day every once in a while, and I'm a little disappointed in myself because I didn't allow myself to enjoy it enough in the moment. I think the overwhelming feeling was relief. I came into
So relief that you can still do it.
Yeah, basically, because I came into that month and there were a lot of talks about would he still be able to, you know, run well at the 500? Because I'd had a decent track record at Indy. I'd qualified in the front row a couple times, and we had had a pre-month test. There's always an April test at Indy, and they had made some fairly significant regulation changes to the aerodynamics of the cars for 2016, and we went there for that test. So my first time back at the track, and it was a disaster. I didn't do a single lap flat. The car felt like it was trying to kill me, and it was very concerning. I had no conscious issue with being at the track, being in the car, trying to go fast. But at that point, I'm thinking, is there something subconscious now? So I don't remember the accident, but maybe my subconscious remembers the accident and thinks, oh, I've been here. We're not doing that again. And of course, everyone on the team, everyone in the paddock, everyone in the media has that same thought. And I was like, guys, I'm telling you, there's something wrong with the car. Typical racing driver, right? It's not, not me, it's the car. But we left that day, and you know, I subsequently found out there were crisis calls between my agent and the team, and you know, like, oh, is he done? Is this it? And I just said, nope, take it back to the shop. We'll come back in May and we'll see what happens. And we took it back to the shop. They claim they found nothing. We go back in May, and second lap, first practice, flat out, no problem.
What changed?
In me, nothing. They'll tell you the car, nothing. I don't know. It gave you 2 weeks of just pure terror that maybe there was something wrong. So I told all my crew, I said, look, for 11 months now, I've been telling this story. We're going to leave this month with a new story to tell. And that was kind of our motivation going into that month. And I think qualifying on pole at Indy is so unique. It's such a cool thing. Qualifying day is, in a lot of ways, it's the coolest day of the year for an IndyCar driver. And it means so much to the teams to know that they built the fastest car, and the differences, you know, you're looking for the smallest amounts. You have to perfect everything on the car, everything on the run. And so there's a lot of pride for teams and for drivers in that day. And I think, that relief kind of came that we'd built up this sort of storybook, you know, this fairy tale story of this comeback. And if we had qualified third, it would have been like, oh yeah, that was good. But like, it wasn't going to be as cool. And so I think getting pole, it was relief. But then my mind immediately switched way too quickly. I let it switch to the race and be like, okay, well now we're starting first. Now we have to win. And so there was immediately this new pressure of, okay, how do we continue this next week?
Were there any lasting effects from the crash the previous year? Did you have a limp? When I was watching Dancing with the Stars, mate, you look fine physically, but maybe you're just putting a smile on it.
No. I mean, if there were 100 things that had to happen just wrong for that accident to happen and that injury to happen, it's a very bizarre, freak sort of thing that happened with the suspension coming through the car and through me. 100 things had to go just wrong for that to happen. 1,000 things had to go just right for me to have not only survived that accident, but leave with no lasting side effects. I've got some cool scars, but no, physically it didn't hold me back in any way.
Do you view life differently now?
Yeah, very much so. One of the questions afterwards very often was, you know, has it changed you? And the answer was professionally, no. Like I was happy to strap back into the car. I would take the same risks. I would, you know, accept the same outcomes. But personally, yeah, in a huge way.
Can you describe a pole lap on an oval like that? How different is it to a road course? I'm thinking of Alonso when he went there in 2017. I think he qualified fifth. Is it a completely different skill set? And you'll understand in a minute why I'm asking you about this, but just, do you get oval specialists or can you do both?
You absolutely get oval specialists. And you nailed it. The description there was perfect. It is a different skill set. You know, it's the same car, the same engine, the same tires for the most part, but it is a completely different skill set. And essentially what it is on a road course or a street course, the inputs you're getting from the car are very big. An oversteer moment's very dramatic. An understeer moment's very dramatic. A lockup is very obvious, right? On an oval at those speeds, everything is so much smaller. You have to recalibrate your senses. Like the first time I went out on an oval in a test and I drove around, they're like, how's the car? I'm like, fine. I'm flat. I'm turning left. I don't know what to tell you. My brain could not comprehend how much understeer that car actually had or if it was on the edge of adhesion in the back. I mean, you have to just fine tune all of your senses to a completely different level. The speed you're going, obviously, you're having to predict things so much further ahead. The way you've got to read traffic is different. Yeah, specifically in a qualifying setup, you know, you are trying to balance this thing on the absolute limit. You know, the old saying, loose is fast, right? So you've got to have the car fairly free. You're pulling as much downforce as you dare off the car. But knowing that if you get it a little wrong, there's usually no coming back. There's very rarely a good save in a qualifying lap on an oval. So it's
how do
daunting.
You know how much to trim the car before it's too late?
It's a bit of roulette, to be honest. You know, the old saying goes, there's two types of drivers on ovals, those that have hit the wall and those that will. Essentially, you've just got to learn to feel it. And it does come from just experience. You've got to build up to it gradually. And that's a good thing about Indy is you have, you know, 5 days of practice, 6 hours a day to kind of slowly work up to that feeling.
Do you think the great drivers can do both? Max Verstappen on an oval?
Yeah, I think he'd figure it out. I really do.
I think of a description that Alex Albon gave recently where he said, Max is so set, you know, the mouse settings on maximum. Mm-hmm. That to me seems absolutely perfect.
Very well suited for ovals. Absolutely. And that's why I do think he would be a very quick study on ovals. Yeah.
The reason we're talking about this is I wanted to ask you about American drivers. I mean, Alex Palou is dominating this year in IndyCar. He won the Indianapolis 500 this year. Could he make it here? And that sounds such an arrogant thing to say, but when you look at his junior career, he ran out of steam in Europe. He had to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to get a read on him over here in Europe.
Right.
Do you think he's got it?
Yes. Yeah, he's the Max of IndyCar. Like I said, if you polled the other 19 drivers here, who's the best on the grid, you probably get a pretty close to unanimous answer. It would be the same in IndyCar right now. And look, obviously that changes, that fluctuates, right? There's a cycle to that. But Palou has done some very, very impressive things behind the wheel of an IndyCar in the last, you know, 36 months. What he's doing this year is just, it's outrageous. You don't see that kind of domination in a, I hate to use this word, but a relatively spec series, right? I mean, there's no element, it's kind of like Max in the sense that there's no element of the game that he is lacking in. You cannot say there's a driver that's better over a single lap, better over a stint on hards, better over a stint on softs, better at restarts, better in laps, better at out laps. There's nothing that he's missing. Again, drivers don't do this in isolation. His team right now is also just absolutely on fire. And it is that combination. It has to be that combination. But I do think, and I mean, Alex did an FP1 at Austin back in 22, I want to say. He did some TPC testing with McLaren, and the feedback was remarkable. I remember watching that first practice that he did, first time driving that car, because everything that he'd been driving was 2 years old. And I think he was 2 tenths off Lando at COTA, which is a long lap, difficult circuit. And that's an impressive display from a driver. So I think he's the real deal.
Our next sponsor is Vanta. Trust isn't just earned, it's demanded. Whether you're a startup founder navigating your first audit or a seasoned security professional scaling your GRC program, proving your commitment to security has never been more critical or more complex. And that's where Vanta can help. Vanta helps companies of all sizes get compliant fast and stay that way, thanks to its industry-leading AI, automation, and continuous monitoring. By automating compliance for more than 35 frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, and HIPAA, Vanta can save you time by centralizing security processes and helping you complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster. And it can save you money too. A recent IDC study showed that Vanta customers slash over $500,000 a year in costs and are 3 times more productive. Establishing trust isn't optional. Vanta makes it automatic. Visit vanta.com/grid to sign up for a free demo today. That's vanta.com/grid. There's more to come from Hinch shortly. I just wanted to let you know about the other official F1 podcast you can listen to this week. F1 Nation's preview of the Dutch Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Jolyon Palmer and Alex Jakes. And this week's F1 Explains is all about pit crews with Haas. That's out on Friday. Just search for F1 Nation and F1 Explains on your podcast app.
Can we talk specifically about American drivers? First, do you think Formula One in America needs an American driver? Because there was this belief. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, Hinch, right? And when back in the Bernie era, there was this belief, we need an American driver, Scott Speed, etc. It feels to me that the sport has broken through now and it doesn't need that. Do you agree?
I do. I do agree that it doesn't need it. Obviously, Formula One in the U.S. is quite healthy at the moment. That said, you know, it's a very proud place, and it's not about needing an American driver, but I do think an American winner would kick it up to a whole nother level. You look at how that country celebrates, you know, their Olympians, for example, right? That's a very big deal, that point of pride. And when you look at a global sport like Formula One, between Cadillac coming in and really embracing the American identity, I think that's going to bring a little bit of pride. But being there isn't good enough. Good enough isn't good enough. If there's an American that's winning races in Formula One, I really think that would be a huge, huge thing back in the States.
Who's the most likely then? Let me throw a name at you. Colton Herta, right?
Right. So he's P1, I think, because he has been in the car. AlphaTauri were kind of actively pursuing him at one point a few years ago. So they've clearly seen something in him. His McLaren test went incredibly well. Andrea Stella had nothing but good things to say about him there. He's had some European experience. You know, he did some of his junior career over in Europe.
Lando's teammate. Actually, Lando does say he was really brave, quick through the fast corners.
There you go. And from Lando, that's a, as he is. So it's so, so different, right? The biggest thing is the tires. The way the tires work in Europe right now compared to how they do in the U.S. is so different that even a driver with some European experience would need to come over here and really do their homework, really put the time in. There'd have to be a lot of prep to get a driver up to speed. But yeah, I mean, Colton is definitely, I think, P1 on the list of
prospects. And is he hungry? If he got the opportunity, got the super license, would he do it?
I believe so. Colton's a little bit like Max in his passion of racing. Colton's not a flashy guy. You know, he's a pretty simple guy. He likes waking up and driving race cars. And he's starting to golf a little bit now, which is concerning. But other than that, you know, I think any opportunity to drive anything, he will do. I think he's been pretty successful in anything that he's driven. Be a massive undertaking. You'd be walking away from a pretty comfortable gig in IndyCar where he's running.
But a gig he could walk back into at any time?
In theory, but you never know. There's no guarantees in the sport, right? So he would have to do it with the understanding that that's a possibility, but there's a small chance that for whatever reason, a good seat's not available on the year he decides to come back, if he decides to come back. So, you know, are you willing to go drive for a back of the grid team and your triumphant return to IndyCar? So there's a lot of things to consider. But yeah, I think ultimately if the opportunity was presented, he would take it.
Hinch, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your time. You've obviously taken to broadcasting like a duck to water. I did want to ask you one thing about that, because you started broadcasting while you were racing. How difficult was it to one weekend be putting a microphone in someone's face and then the next weekend be wanting to beat them?
Very tough. Very tough. You know, in 2020, I did a partial season in IndyCar and curtailed it with, or dovetailed it, sorry, with some TV work on the races that I wasn't doing. And that was very difficult. That was a challenging year.
How did the drivers react to you with a microphone?
The drivers were great. I mean, they're all friends, right? Your colleagues, yes, your enemies on the racetrack, but there's the camaraderie, I think, in the U.S. is a little bit different. I think the IndyCar paddock's a little bit different than certainly some of the European paddocks when you talk to guys that have come over.
Why do you think that is? I'm interested.
I don't know why that is, because I remember when we ran A1GP it had very much a North American feel, and all the drivers made that comment. I didn't know any different, but all the European guys, all the guys that were running, you know, I guess it was GP2 at the time or whatever, were saying like, oh yeah, this is just fun. We're having more fun here. And I don't know why, because it's not like the racing's any less serious. It's not like we're not, you know, putting the same kind of pressure on ourselves when we're in the cars. But yeah, something about the off-track quality of life's a little bit different.
Is it because the IndyCar season is so intense? You're back to back to back to back to back until it's done, and that you guys are just a traveling circus?
I think the traveling circus part is accurate, and you know, a lot of drivers, you have motorhomes, you stay at the racetrack, so you're essentially living in a little community together. You know each other's families, you watch each other's children grow up. I mean, so it is kind of like a big family. Like a family, you have family members you like more than others. You fight like family, and eventually you get over it and you move on, because they're going to be there tomorrow and they're going to be there next week. So holding grudges is really, you know, a pointless endeavor. But no, yeah, the drivers were always really supportive, and they were great. It was all the internal stuff that you're battling in that sense.
Hinch, two more things. Can I get a prediction out of you for the championship in Formula One? No points for saying McLaren are going to win the Constructors'
That's
Championship.
That's literally what I was going to say. it's such a tough one. It is such a tough one.
Do you think it'll go down to the wire? Or do you think, could you see one of them, Lando or Oscar, getting a bit of a distance?
At this point, well, you know, where we are now, round 14, when we're having this chat, 10 races to go. I think there is still enough time for one of them to, when the pressure really starts to mount, separate themselves. But it still does seem like there are tracks that are going to suit one better than the other. And they are so close that your, you know, advantage track is probably going to fall your way, barring some issue or whatever. And I haven't done enough analysis of the remaining 10 races to really pick and choose who I think's got more tracks coming up that suit them. So honestly, at this point, it's so hard to tell.
Is it going to be track suitability, or is it going to be who deals with the pressure best?
Yes.
Is it going to be the mental side that wins this more than car setup and feel? And
I think it's all of it.
Yeah, true.
I really do think it's all of it. They are so closely matched, though, that, yeah, at the end of the day, I think the driver that is able to execute the most consistently as the pressure mounts will likely be the one that's, you know, holding the trophy at the end.
Brilliant. Hinch, look, final one. I'm asking everyone on the pod this year. F1 is 75 years old. Do you have a favorite moment or a favorite memory from the 75 years of Formula One?
Jacques Jerez, 97.
Okay.
Jacques taking the championship. The outrage that I felt against Michael Schumacher on the day. It was a really powerful day for a young Canadian kid who had followed, you know, Jacques' IndyCar career, followed his transition over Formula One, thought he should have won the championship in his rookie year. This was going to be the year. And then the way it all went down in that final race, I mean, pure drama. You couldn't write a better script. And yeah, I'll never forget that day. I remember exactly where I was when the race was going on. And it was, you know, a very proud moment as a Canadian, you know, wannabe hopeful racing driver to see Canada get their first F1 world champion.
And it was crazy close, wasn't it? Do you remember in qualifying we had
the three drivers in the exact same
lap
Williams
time. And Michael were to three decimal places.
Yeah. Too good.
Peak Formula One.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hinch, thank you so much for your time.
Of course, thanks for having me on.
Who can forget Jerez 97? So much at stake and so much drama on track. Imagine for a second if we had a similar final race showdown between Norris and Piastri this year. Now, I love this chat with Hinch. He just knows racing and he understands its idiosyncrasies, which makes him such an interesting guest. I loved his take on Oscar and Lando and on Max. I want to see Max have a go on an oval just for a test, to see how he gets on. As Hinch says, I'm sure he'd be quick from the get-go. Hinch, thanks for your time. I love that. And I look forward to seeing you again soon when you're back with the F1 Circus in a few weeks' time. Well, that's almost it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One.
F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.